Very nice. I'd like to pick up on some of Julie's thoughts, particularly the idea of variance, and just mention something that we came upon, and I'm somebody on the measurement side, and this was in support of the National Academy Keck Futures Initiative, trying to figure out how to measure more interdisciplinary. And this is a conceptual footing that we came upon later from Andy Sterling, from coming from the eco-sciences, but the notion that you can focus on diversity as a three-dimensional body of factors and then go out to measure and study. And I think that would carry forward into the team science, how to do it better notion. And the three dimensions are variety, balance, and disparity. So if you think of what you're putting together, whether it's disciplines or other factors, and definitely it's not just disciplines, pretty interesting, I think, to think about. I don't know if you've come upon it, but if not, I would recommend it.
Thanks, Alan. Alan and I have been working together along with Kate on another project lately on measurement, and we found what was most interesting in that project was that the object of negotiation throughout the project was the word measurement. And we made a major shift to thinking towards evaluation. But I think you have raised a very good possibility, but I think each, this is mindful of what Steve was saying, any approach, any model has to be tested in the context in which it's to be deployed. And so it raises an interesting question, too, about what should training impose? How should we approach training? We should give people toolkits, but we should also teach them how to work with them in a flexible fashion and to think about how they need modification. It's a dance of modification and application.
Thanks. That was, I think, for me, about 3 one-hour lectures, and I've got to go away and do a lot of homework. So my question to you, speaking as a biology professor who's been leading an interdisciplinary research institute for the last 4 years, coming at it purely from science and having to learn about this from the ground up, I wonder a couple of questions. First of all, what does the research show when you assemble an interdisciplinary team where really conflicting ideological differences emerge? So if I've got a biology professor or a physics professor and a business school professor and someone from environmental studies who is Marxian in their background and I'm trying to get them all to work together. They are so different. Is there a point at which one just gives up because they won't even speak to each other? What do we do there? And then the other question that I have is I wondered where Tuckman, 1965, forming, norming, and performing fits, because that for me has been a model that's been quite useful just to throw out to all of my colleagues and say, okay, guys, we got to get through these phases and let's just do the storming bit really fast. Have we given up on him or is he still referred to? Thanks.
I think that the nature of the conflict that you described is probably one of the most interesting aspects of interdisciplinarity. And from the organizational sciences, there's a useful heuristic to think about that type of conflict. They differentiate between relational conflict and task conflict. So you can think about that as cognitive conflict versus affective or emotional conflict. And what we need to better understand is the degree to which this type of conflict is facilitatory of scientific problem solving or inhibitory of scientific problem solving. And you need to listen carefully as a leader of these kinds of institutes which members of those teams hold a type of disciplinary disdain, that is, they don't respect the ideas coming from other people, versus those that hold kind of respect for ideas that come from other disciplines. And it sounds like you have a little bit of both there, and the exciting aspect is that true innovation can come from the cognitive and task-focused conflict as long as you can manage this relational or interpersonal conflict.
That's such a great question. It's so important. Myra Strober has a new book coming out from Stanford University Press out of this month or in the very near future on the nature of interdisciplinary conversations. And she studied a group of conversations where people were brought together with funding to have intellectual dialogue together as teams. And the outcomes differed dramatically. You describe people with very strong ideological differences. In a number of cases, the teams found ways to talk with each other. In one case, the team was a bust. it just didn't fly, and that we have to accept that reality of happening. There are ways of unpacking all that stuff, though, and I wondered if the Idaho team is here. Steve, Dan had just mentioned the two of, there they are. Identify yourselves. Steve and Renee. Is Renee here? Steve and Renee, just mention what you're doing later, because you have developed, as Dan was pointing out, the toolkit for unpacking some of the stuff. So are you in line?
I was just about there. Yes.
Super. We will be hearing shortly from him.
I just want to pick up on something Steve said about leaders. I think when you have those kinds of vertical integrations, let's say in a health team initiative going from cells to society, where you have so many different worldviews of science coming together, it's important to anticipate debate and conflict. I think a lot of times people go into team projects with a very rosy picture and set of expectations that everything is going to be all harmonious, and I think it's important to plan on some of that conflict and ways of negotiating and resolving it. And I think the leader in those situations is very, very important and crucial, that they be inclusive, that they be sensitive to the fact that interpersonal tensions are building and how to diffuse some of that, and to get people converging rather than simply diverging. But the leader plays an incredibly important role. If that doesn't happen effectively, often the different groups within a large team initiative will go back into their silos and just work separately, even though they're under the umbrella of an interdisciplinary project.
Hi, Kara Hall from NCI. I'm wondering if the panel can remark. Well, so Steve, you had mentioned that you define interdisciplinarity as teamwork and as a process. And one of the things that we've struggled in trying to understand, for instance, the transdisciplinary initiatives that we have going, is that when we define transdisciplinarity with a focus on the process, our challenge of understanding exactly how to look at the outcomes and consider the outcomes in the context of transdisciplinarity or interdisciplinarity somehow gets a little bit shortchanged by focusing on the definition of process. So I'm wondering if the panel can talk about how do we need separate definitions or terms that focus on process versus outcome, or how can we deal with that?
I'll start. Yeah, in the teamwork literature, there is a differentiation between the processes and the products that emerge from teamwork. And I think when you talk about transdisciplinarity as a process, what you're really trying to articulate, as I think was described earlier, are the theoretical framework that is produced a priori, kind of from the top-down standpoint. But it sounds like what you lose sight of is that framework is devised for a very specific purpose, to produce a solution to a complex problem. So when you realize that you need to solve a complex problem, you can begin to think about what the product should be. So the products in this case are not facilitated teamwork. The products here are the solutions that come out of those interactions. So whether that be a new medicine, whether it be a new social program, if you think about what you want to produce, then you'll get a better sense of what particular processes could lead to those products, that is the solutions of that kind of problem solving.
I think in considering Patricia Rosenfield's continuum from uni to multi to inter to transdisciplinarity, efforts to try to evaluate and assess when transdisciplinarity is reached as sort of the nirvana have been very difficult, and kind of there's a fuzzy boundary between those two parts of her continuum. And some have suggested that what constitutes transdisciplinary products or innovations are those that represent something fundamentally new from what has been before, something that breaks out of a paradigm and creates a new one. This is not, you know, an accepted definition, but it's one direction of thinking as to what constitutes a transdisciplinary innovation. One of the ironies about transdisciplinary products, and the NIH and the Roadmap Initiative defined interdisciplinarity as the creation of hybrid fields. And often when these new hybrid fields come into existence, like psychoneuroimmunology, for example, they're very new and novel at the beginning, but over time they acquire their own conventions and their own conferences and their own journals, and they become sort of an accepted language, as Julie would say. So to what extent does that remain transdisciplinary, or does there then have to be another innovation that sort of goes even beyond that hybrid? So those are some of the complexities I think we're still grappling with. We don't have easy answers to.
I think it's very important to realize that these are really states of action and states of thinking, because when someone is involved in an interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary project, they don't necessarily stop being interdisciplinary or stop being professional. And it's not a strictly linear process. Studies of the integrative process have shown very clearly that people move around. They move, they become, they have disciplinary, interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary, and other actions that they're engaged in. And it's not, it doesn't get to one end point. It moves back.
Jack Pincus with Silicon Technologies. Dr. Klein mentioned the importance of a common language in transdisciplinary sciences. And what I'm curious about, in transdisciplinary sciences where the language of each of the practices is so different and so unique, are there any examples where somebody has found a way to bridge the gap between the disciplines? The disparities in language are particularly evident in the life sciences when you have physicists, computer scientists, biologists, and clinicians trying to collaborate. So in a situation like that, are there any examples of finding a common language?
Well, I think Stephen, who's going to talk about the toolbox workshop approach at Idaho, is designed to sort of transcend some of those language barriers among people coming from very different disciplinary perspectives, and perhaps can speak more specifically about that approach.
That's where I think the notion of pidgins and creoles is very important, because people develop interim tongues. There have been some studies of interdisciplinary communication that show when people come together, they create a language that's a hybrid of everyday terminology and what they learn from each other, although just because they think they know what a word means in common doesn't mean it necessarily operates that way. There's a bite-back factor. And so there have been interim languages, but then new languages emerge all the time. Feminist theory, structuralism, sociobiology, new discourses emerge, and then they become new tongues that people have in common. But Steve, why don't you take it here?
Thank you very much.
The much introduced Steve Crowley.
Yeah, there's no way I'm going to live up to that. That introduction. So, folks, Steve Crowley from Boise State University. I'm part of a NSF team working in Idaho. Yes, the NSF has made it all the way to Idaho, which and our particular focus is looking at some of these issues around promoting communication in cross-disciplinary teams which are coming from different backgrounds. So this is by way of a shameless prompt. We're here. We'd like to sell you our product. We've got a really awesome conference coming up a little bit later in the year. It's in Coeur d'Alene, which will be absolutely gorgeous. So plan to head west. The fishing, if nothing else, will be spectacular. So the end of like sales pitch, one of the things that's been interesting is in listening to the conversation about the struggles to find a common language, is we begin from this sense of conflict or difference. And one of the interesting challenges we've found in doing our work is a point that Julie just alluded to. And Julie and Daniel, thank you both very much for the push. But one of the real challenges often begins from, as were, the assumption of similarity. So that it's actually often not areas of conflict, because often, people will come ready to negotiate what they recognize to be their differences. But the challenge can actually be those things that you know that everyone does the same way that you do. And so one of the things we like to think that our toolbox approach does is encourage people to identify, before you can disagree, discover those areas of disagreement. So I guess I wanted to just announce our existence. Please come and visit with Renee and I. We're going to try and visit with as many of you as possible. I'm going to zip it now, but I guess I was interested in particularly in hearing from the panel their thoughts about the point Julie just made about as it were, discovering areas of disagreement, because I think that's often an overlooked part of the challenge of cross-disciplinarity. Thank you.
That's such an important point. Margaret Baron-Lewski did a book a long time ago where she studied mental health care teams, and she discovered that people would often agree to be nice and get on with the project, that they have the same meaning in mind when they use the term such as aggression. But then they'd get down the road and think they were making progress and found the project scuttled because they really hadn't talked about the differences. And so I think there's a very rich work that's been done on the notion of communicative rationality, where people talk very candidly about whether or not they do have the same meaning. And this is where the notion, I think, borrowed from the earlier STS as well, science technology studies, of bridge concepts, that there are concepts that enable people to bridge their differences. And there are a lot of case studies that show how, well, for example, urban transportation problems that show how people spend time figuring out what they mean by urban, suburban, exurban, what urbanity is. Then they negotiate how that would be mapped, what it would require, what the stakes are. And in that process of negotiation and mapping, some very interesting visual mapping uses, they manage to get to a point where they can agree on both what they agree on and what they differ on. And the differences don't go away. Generative tension is one of the most important props here in the process.
Go ahead. No, just building on what Julie said, I think it's really important to try to stem the problem of disappointed expectations. And often people come in assuming they're very similar, they can work together, and then over time they get surprised at all the areas of conflict and disagreement, and they maybe give up or they get disillusioned. So to the extent that you can bring out those areas of potential areas of disagreement early and sort of plan for, okay, how are we going to resolve these along with our similarities, I think is really valuable.
I wanted to add that in addition to the assumption of similarity, there's also the assumption of differences. And oftentimes what you'll see is as the dialogue unfolds, you'll realize that when you thought you were talking about something different, you're actually talking about the same concept. So this kind of disciplinary multilingualism is an important issue that needs to be addressed, and I think group communication research can help us do that, and maybe there could be interventions that can be designed to address that. I also wanted to add, Dan raised a point earlier about the vertical integration issue, and this is something that I would like to see explored within the science of team science, that is the different forms of challenges when you move at a vertical level versus a horizontal level. So I've done both in my research. In a vertical level, I've worked with neuroscientists to understand some complex contextual social issues, but I've also worked at the horizontal level to work with economists, for example, to look at some social phenomena. And what we need to understand is how the different disciplinary tensions arise when you move from this vertical level as opposed to a horizontal level, and how there might be significant differences in language uses across those levels.